from Dr. Ben Brook, who's an associate professor with tenure at the University of Utah, currently chief of the Vascular Surgery Division and chief of the Health Services Research Section within the Department of Surgery, and also the director of the Utah Intervention Quality Implementation Research Program. He'll be discussing implementation science within the context of his work related to improved patient care transitions across surgical episodes.
Thanks, Sam and Phil, for putting together this this session. We had a panel on implementation at the Surgical Outcomes Club meeting this past Sunday, and there was a lot of a lot of interest in the subject. And I think it's one of those topics where surgeons are still trying to figure out how to apply it to their own research. But clearly, we need to find out a little bit more about it and be able to utilize it. I don't have any disclosures for my presentation. So this is a often cited, the evidence gap that we are well aware of, that it takes on average about 17 years to take an innovative research concept and take it through the pathway until it's able to impact clinical practice. This also impacts surgical practice, where we have a lot of new technology devices and new processes of care that can surely impact how we take care of our patients. However, as you can see here, there's a lot of innovative practices that developed over the last decade, including some of the work from Dr. Goodney, that clearly hasn't made its way through the pathway where it's implemented routinely within clinical practice. So what I wanted to talk to you today was just how we can utilize implementation science within surgery to bridge this evidence gap, go over some of the different implementation science models and frameworks, how to select a model for your project, and then finally some of my own work where I've utilized some of these models to implement a project looking at evidence-based perioperative pain management. So what is implementation science? The previous presentation went through a fairly good definition of it, but it's this definition of the uptake of scientific methods to study the uptake of evidence-based practices into healthcare policy and practice. And implementation studies are these that are taking the findings from both efficacy and effectiveness studies and trying to adapt them for different clinical settings and then make these sustainable over time. This is not to be confused with quality improvement projects, which are more, given that we're implementation science is employing both mixed methods across multiple layers, is requiring a very solid grounding in models or theory-based practice, and really seeks to implement or deploy the utilization of innovations over the long-term stretch so that they can be impacting clinical practice. Now, clearly, we have a lot of these innovations, as I've referred to. So, what are the barriers to implementing these surgical interventions into our own clinical settings? Well, if you think about it, I mean, a lot of what we want to use in surgery is, very expensive, requires a lot of training to be able to be, an expert. And it's also sometimes, very hard to, it's very specific for different practice settings. And so, if you want to adopt one of these things, I mean, you have to understand how you can adopt it for your own specific setting. A lot of times when we try to do this, though, there are a lot of competing demands at our own institutions. There's limited resources and time. And also, a lot of times there's also perverse incentives not to use an evidence-based technology, even though it would be shown to improve patient care. Third, a lot of times the evidence that is used to justify the new use of a new innovative practice is not necessarily done in such a way that we can adapt it to our own clinical settings. I mean, a lot of times one of the main barriers is randomized clinical trials are very specific, and they're not generalizable for all different settings. So when we think about it, I mean, there's a lot of these different barriers that come together and coalesce, and it leads to an inability to implement evidence-based interventions into routine clinical practice across different clinical settings. So one of the reasons why we use implementation science is to try to bridge this evidence gap and these barriers. Implementation science is composed of models, which are really, you know, we could think of as theories or frameworks for trying to organize the world around us. I mean, trying to provide some organized structure for all parts of the studies that we want to implement. And this includes both the study design, the aims, the activities, methods, measures, and all parts of the evaluation process. And through this, we're able to, you know, through these models, elucidate different barriers and facilitators for our interventions, ensure that we include all essential implementation strategies across the entire project, and hopefully enhance the interpretability of our study findings once they're in practice. So how do we select an implementation science model? Well, you know, it can become a little confusing and a little bit of frustration when you think about all the different models that have come out over the last, you know, several decades. I mean, right now there's over 70 different models to choose from. So fortunately, there was a nice review paper that was published by Rachel Tabak and co-authors from Brown that went through, I think, a fairly good step-by-step strategy for how to select a model. I mean, the first step one is to really think about the constructs that you want for your model. Do you need them to be fairly loosely defined and flexible, or do you want them to be very detailed and step by step? The next step is to say, am I trying to disseminate an intervention? Do I want to, you know, spread it to a lot of different practice settings, or am I more focused on just trying to implement it within my own practice setting or within a very limited scope? So these are the first two things you need to think about. But then step three is to decide what level of implementation you want to go after. Is it really at a provider level, or even like your hospital level? Or are you thinking more about the community or a broad policy focus? And again, all these things come together to decide, you know, how you want to implement. So the authors of this systematic review put together this nice table which shows how you can kind of coalesce these three different factors and essentially come down with a somewhat of a rational way of selecting a model. But even this still can be sometimes a little confusing. Another strategy that I find is helpful is to think about implementation along the spectrum from the clinical effectiveness to implementation, and that's where this concept of hybrid models comes along. Hybrid models are those that are trying to combine both implementation and measures of effectiveness within a common model, and this is defined to help speed this knowledge translation pathway. As you can see, there's three different types, really kind of depending on where you are on the spectrum. If you're more at the stage where you're trying to get a measure of clinical effectiveness, but you still also want to gain some insightful, you know, into your implementation strategies, you might pick a type 1 model, whereas type 2 models are those that simultaneously test both clinical effectiveness and implementation. And then type 3 are those that are more weighted on the implementation side, but are still gathering outcomes of clinical effectiveness for your study. And just to kind of walk you through, to give you an example, so let's say that you have an ERAS protocol. I mean, obviously ERAS has been, you know, what we consider evidence-based now, and it's been applied for a lot of different surgical practices like colorectal surgery and whatnot. But let's say that you're trying to take an ERAS protocol and adopt it to a new surgical practice that's never been tested before. So that might be a place where a type 1 model, a hybrid model, would be useful. So you might be saying, I want to test whether ERAS is more effective than usual care. I want to do this at a patient level and look at health outcomes. Whereas let's say that you had an ERAS protocol that you wanted to look at for colorectal surgery, where it's clearly been evidence-based, but now your question is the strategy of doing more tailored provider education for ERAS versus usual care, that's really where your exposure is, and you might be looking at both providers and process measures for your outcome for this study. And then a type 3 hybrid model is where you're really trying to really test the implementation strategy, but you also still might want to get some clinical outcomes and effectiveness studies, but you know, your primary outcome is really the uptake of the strategy and not the clinical effectiveness. So how does this all work in practice? So I wanted to go through my own experience with using implementation models and kind of go through a project that we've been doing at our Salt Lake City VA that's ongoing right now. And to start with this, we turned to a conceptual model for applying implementation science to surgical practice that Dr. Finlayson and I published a couple years ago in JAMA Surgery, which is a step-by-step application of how to go through implementation science from a surgical perspective. And what we did is we adapted this framework from the consolidated framework for implementation research. Some of you might have heard of CIFR, which is a fairly common implementation strategy, but it's broken into both pre-implementation as well as implementation itself. And I think it's important important to sometimes, you know, conceptually divide those two, because your pre-implantation is really trying to figure out how to adopt your strategy to your particular setting, and then the implementation process itself is a little bit different. But let me just go through. So step one in this model is to first identify a high-risk surgical problem. So what's a high-risk surgical problem? Well, in our model, we wanted to look at opioid abuse. So this is a figure that was taken from a recent paper published by Dr. Bratt, who's luckily in the audience, so he can provide some more insight if need be. But essentially, we all know that opioid overuse has become a real problem in surgical practice. And from this graph, you can see that the initial duration of opioid use after surgery is significantly increased over time. And as you can see, patients who are receiving increasing opioid use from 4 days on is gradually gone up over time. And as that's increased in time, also the duration, opioid abuse rate is also going up. So this has clearly become a major problem that we're trying to address right now. And there's a lot of data that's come out in the surgical literature recently, but we all know this is a problem. So the next step is, how do we address this problem? Well, step two is to select a surgical intervention to address this. Well, we turn to, the guidelines that have been published on the management of postoperative pain from all the different major pain societies and surgical societies, and there's clearly a lot of different strategies that have been, that have already, developed evidence that is shown to be effective for addressing this problem. From a patient-focused strategy, the first thing is to identify specific patient risk factors, history of mental health factors, history of substance abuse, providing patient-centered education. It's been shown to set expectations and norms for patients before surgery. It's been shown to be effective, but then also reinforcing that along the along an episode of surgical care, and then also discussing options for safe opioid disposal. Patients who have pills left over after surgery, what should they do? How should they dispose of them? Actually, providing some education on that before surgery. There's also very defined provider-focused strategies, including limiting the quantity and duration of opioid use in hospitals and discharge. There's been a lot of research that's come out of the Michigan group for basically defining how many pills we should be giving surgical patients at the time of discharge. There's also a lot of evidence about how to encourage non-opioid pharmacological therapies such as acetaminophen, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, giving these around the clock, also giving gabapentin and pregabalin before surgery. And then finally, encouraging non-pharmacological therapies such as things that are really focusing on behavioral cognitive modalities. One of the things that we've been focused on is mindfulness. And one of the reasons for this last strategy is really, if you look at this conceptual model for the process involved in the development of chronic post-surgical pain, you can see that psychosocial issues that you can really intervene with behavioral cognitive interventions are those that have been shown to be evidence-based and to be effective. So we wanted to combine these things into a pathway. So the third thing is to assess, we have this intervention, we have some evidence-based practice measures. How do we actually adopt into our practice setting? So, we were interested in doing this at our Salt Lake City VA, implementing a evidence-based multimodal interventions to prevent chronic post-surgical pain. We also realized that to do this, we also had to think about how to create a pathway for communication, and that's where we turned to some informatics tools. But we wanted to do this from the whole perioperative surgical pathway, so this is something that we put together. So, part of the pre-implementation assessment is to look at these contextual factors within your practice setting. So the outer setting would be, we had to think about, what are the VA opioid safety initiatives, and how does, these guidelines that we want to actually implement, how would they fit into what's already been put into practice? We were also doing this in the context of another initiative called the Whole Health program that the VA just rolled out. We also had to think about, how does our intervention fit into CDC guidelines and other federal and state laws? So this is what we constitute as the outer setting. The inner setting is what is the actual practice environment that we need to put this in? What is the culture of opioid use within our own clinical practice setting at the Salt Lake City VA? If we do this, are there going to be competing interests at our VA that are going to basically try to make it hard for us to do this? Or are we going to be pushing up against other opioid initiatives that are already ongoing? And then also, what's the infrastructure for communication between providers? providers. So if we want to do things, how do we make sure that there is a sense of shared cognition of these interventions between different providers? And then finally, you know, we have to talk to all the different, you know, providers that are going to be implementing these practices as well as overseeing. So, you know, what are their knowledge and beliefs? Do they believe in these things, or do they feel like this is just, you know, a lot of, you know, researchers trying to implement something that's not really going to be helpful for patients? You know, what is the ability of our team to actually adapt to new practices, and their self-efficacy for developing new programs? So all these things are where we came together, and we actually did a number of semi-structured interviews and focus groups over multiple months to gain some sense of you know, how, you know, we were going to be either running up against a lot of barriers, or whether there's going to be some elements that would facilitate the implementation of these practices within our practice model. So the next step was to say, okay, well, how do we adapt all these different interventions into one, you know, common practice that we could actually implement? So that's where we, you know, we took all the information from these focus groups and interviews and put together what we call the transitional pain service, where we packaged all these different multimodal interventions into one practice setting that is a service, essentially, that's our acute pain service. But what we did is we hired some additional people to help implement these practices, including nurse educators, as well as a pain psychologist to implement our behavioral cognitive interventions. And we also realized that we needed some sort of information platform to be able to organize the delivery of the system. So we built some dashboards that I'll show you that help both panel patients and organize, but also allow us to assess some of our outcomes for implementation. So this is what the transitional pain service stratification. A patient comes in having surgery at the Salt Lake CDVA. They're first screened by our nurse educator. If they're deemed to be low risk, meaning they don't have any risk factors for opioid or substance abuse, or it's just a minor surgery, they're just going to get the normal pathway, which is just getting some handouts for pain education. But if they're deemed to be higher risk, meaning they have risk factors for opioid or substance abuse, or if they're undergoing a major surgery, such as like a thoracotomy or a spine surgery, where we know they're going to have a high need for opioids, then they are enrolled into our system. And we have this program that is really based on perioperative, intraoperative, and then postoperative care, whereby we have a nurse educator that sees them, we have a pain psychologist that sees them, we put together a very patient-centered care plan that then is then followed during the entire episode of care, so that we're reinforcing the same sort of behaviors and education patterns that, you know, from some of the evidence-based interventions that I already laid out, but we do that at every step of the pathway. We also follow these patients that are more high risk up to 6 months after surgery to ensure that if they're opioid naive before surgery, that they're off opioids, or if they came in on chronic opioids, that we've at least been able to decrease their dependency, or we've been able to stop it completely, and we've had fairly good success with that so far. So the next step is to say, okay, we've adapted the surgical intervention, but how do we actually, you know, take an implementation strategy and put this into practice? You know, this is a good conceptual framework for the pre-implementation, but, you know, in my mind, you know, for implementation, you need a more, what we call a hybrid model that I already discussed. So the REAIM is a classic hybrid model that we've been able to use in several different studies. REAIM stands for reach. You know, are you reaching your intended target population? There's also a measure of effectiveness, adoption, implementation, as well as maintenance of your interventions. So for our project, this is how we went through this. So for REACH, we were trying to look at, you know, what are the number and proportion of patients that actually got this intervention? These are the questions that we asked. You know, did the TPS program reach the patients that were most in need? And we were able to actually have, you know, a numerator and a denominator for this, and we were able to capture this both with our dashboard as well as different data sources. Effectiveness, again, was looking at the impact of the program on clinical outcomes. The clinical outcomes we were looking at were the proportion of patients on opioids 6 months after surgery, were they on what was their mean opioid milliequivalents. We also looked at how many people got refills within the scope of time after they were discharged to the six-month follow-up period. And we were able to capture this all in our dashboard, which I'll show you. Adoption was the willingness of providers to within the VA to adopt this program for high-risk patients. Was there any resistance? Did this fall in line with the VA healthcare mission, you know, that was set up? Implementation fidelity. Dr. Schreck already kind of went through some of the, you know, what fidelity means, but are all the different components we were trying to implement, are they actually being carried out? And again, To assess this, we were using interviews and staff surveys to follow up on this. And then finally, maintenance. To which part does our program actually become part of the VA culture? Is it sustained over time? This is something that's going to take a while to assess, but again, we'll go back and we'll use interviews and staff surveys to assess this. So finally, we're at the stage of we've implemented this in practice, and I mentioned that we were using a dashboard that we'd built that is part of our electronic healthcare system that we can actually push data from our EHR, which is CRPRS, into this dashboard. So we're able to collect a lot of outcomes. So what this looks like right now is we've got this dashboard. We've got a way to collect all the patients and see all the patients who got screened as well as those who screened out. So we can actually, ensure that this is a way to collect to make sure that, that reach, are we actually reaching all the patients that we intend? And we can actually capture this electronically. So every time you open up a patient's chart, you can also look at all these other factors that we're interested in looking at. What were their risk factors for substance abuse or opioid abuse? What were their opioid and non-opioid medications that they're currently taking? Also, for the patients who are undergoing a cognitive behavioral modality, we're using mindfulness right now. What stage are they at? Are they at the preoperative, the intraoperative, the postoperative stage? And so we can assess and see again, is our fidelity being reached for this given intervention? And then we can also trend the outcomes for our patients. So this is what our dashboard looks like for both an assessment of their morphine and milligram equivalents, where were they before surgery, at the time that they were in the hospital for surgery, and then postoperative. And we have this scale so that we know if they're in kind of a normal range or if they're at a range where they're outside a standard deviation from where they should be. We're also looking at promise measures where we're having nurse educators call back patients and get a patient self-reported estimate of where they are in terms of their pain intensity, pain catastrophizing, and other patient self-reported outcomes for how they're managing with this program. So this is again a great way to manage the outcomes for a study like this. So here are my take-home points. First of all, implementation models provide structure to translational research and surgery. Again, it's something that we need to think about, from the start of our projects. I mean, you need to integrate your research proposals from the concept of the implementation model from the start, I think, to make sure that you gather and collect all the constructs that are going to be important. There's many different models to choose from. There's no one right model. I mean, there's multiple models that you could use. And you can also combine more than one model, as we did in the project that I just showed you. And finally, I really think that informatics tools are a great way to become an adjunct to implementation science because, a lot of times there's a lot of moving parts and an ability to collect data and to also collect a lot of the implementation outcomes. You need to have implementation tools to be able to do that. So thanks. I want to acknowledge all the people that have been working with me on this project over the last year and a half, and happy to take any questions after the next presentation. Thank you.